There is enclosed, attached to your notes for tonight, there is a set of readings. I will have an expanded version for those who would like to read the whole Bible next year, in 2014. This will get you through half of the Bible. What it is the 11 chronological books of the Old Testament. Anyone remember which ones those are? No fair peeking. Genesis, Exodus, Numbers,
First and Second Samuel,
Joshua, Judges, First Samuel, Second Samuel, First Kings, Second Kings, Ezra, Nehemiah. Those are the 11 chronological books of the Old Testament, and they will take you from the beginning of creation, clear up to 400 years before Christ. There were no Old Testament books written during the 400 years before Jesus came. They are called the 400 silent years. Sometime we'll have a message where we'll talk about God's gracious provision during that period of time. And then we have the entire New Testament. And I have not arranged the readings in the sequence that you'll find them in your English Bible. They are instead arranged in chronological sequence. And if you look at the back page, you'll notice that I have rearranged the Gospels. John is first. Then Matthew, then Mark, then Luke, so that Luke is next to Acts. Because Luke and Acts are two volumes but one book. So they've done a disservice when we have those two books split apart. Mm-hmm. And the sequence of Paul's writings are in the sequence in which he wrote them. So you can't go on autopilot and just turn forward in your Bible.
Good.
Now, I will prepare also a list to go along with this that will take us through those who want to read the rest of the Old Testament. Then it will have the poetic books and the prophetic books in their chronological sequence. And the idea would then be to double the speed on reading. Here, you'll notice it's a six-day-a-week reading schedule. There's a simple reason I've given you 6 days. Number one, it makes it so that if you fall behind, you've got a day to catch up. Number two, the day that I scheduled, now you can schedule whatever day off you want, but the day that I scheduled off was Thursday, because you're probably going to be working on memory verses. I know how we all are. So in other words, what this is a reading schedule of between 1 and 2 chapters a day. I went through in Excel, and if it was a longer chapter, I gave you one chapter. If it was shorter chapters, I put 2 in a day. And so all of this is designed to have it be a relatively balanced amount of reading. And it's a very helpful thing to read the Bible chronologically. Most people don't do that, but it's a fun thing to see how their understanding expanded as time went on. And when we don't read on a chronological schedule, we kind of lose track of the flow of history. And I think that it's a great help for us to see how it is that God has revealed his truth. There will be a change in the format when we come back, January 2nd. We'll be traveling. We're going to be going to California. And so we'll be visiting family, and I'll be speaking at some churches. But when we come back, what I am going to do is open it up at the beginning of each session for questions on the week's reading. So, in other words, if you have read it and you've kept up, then the question and answer session, as we're going through and dealing with those sections, will make more sense. So it will give a context. So I'd rather not load us down with a lot of reading, but have it set up so that it's a reasonable amount to read, and then I can handle some of the issues that come up in those sections. And I think it'll be fun. We finished a little early on our chronological read during 2013, so we've already started in Genesis. So, okay. Any other news that I'm needing to bring up? We won't be meeting for the next 2 weeks. I think that we would solicit your prayers as we're traveling.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
We'll be putting out a few miles. It looks like we'll have good weather going out, which is always fun. So, I wanted to give a little different perspective on the Christmas story than what you normally hear in church. And so I think an appropriate place for us to start is by thinking to our walkthrough. Let's see, Genesis 1 and 2 talked about
creation.
Genesis 3 is the fall. 4, Becky, you like 4.
Oh, I do?
Yes. 4 is brotherly love. That's where Cain murdered Abel.
Yes, that's right. Brotherly love. How could I forget that, John?
Chapters 5 and 10 are genealogies. Mm-hmm. And so when we give explanations on them, The two genealogies are from different standpoints. Oh. There are different kinds of genealogies. And the one in Genesis 5 is of one type, and the one in Genesis 10 is a different type. And there is a purpose in all genealogies. A major feature of what the genealogies were demonstrating was the lineage that Jesus came out of, that was promised way back at the time of the fall in Genesis. Where was the fall? Genesis
3.
Okay. So 1 and 2 is creation. Chapter 3 is the fall. 4 is brotherly love. 5 and 10 are genealogies. 6 through 8, the flood. And chapter 9 is the Noahic covenant. That's where God made a peace treaty with planet Earth. And his symbol of the peace treaty was a bow, the rainbow. But it was a bow that was hanging on the wall. That's where you put a bow when you're not at war. That's where you put the bow at time of peace. So the bow was used as a symbol of God had hung the bow up. He was no longer at war with planet Earth. Chapter 10 is what?
Genealogy.
5 and 10 are genealogies. So we have chapter 10, that's genealogies. Chapter 11, Tower of Babel. Tower of Babel didn't look like this. It was a ziggurat. It would look more like this. But you can think of 11. It looks sort of like an 11.
Oh, that's how I remember. Mm-hmm. Okay.
And chapter 12. That's where God called Abraham. Chapters 12 through 25 are focusing upon Abraham. And then from after that we have, let's see, if you think about Abraham, how many sons do we normally think of him having?
Two.
And they were?
Ishmael
and Isaac. Isaac had two sons. They were twins. Jacob and Esau. And then Jacob had 12 sons and...
Who was in the kitchen with Dinah? We were talking about that in Cambodia. We were talking about that in Cambodia.
Okay, that's probably enough background to get us started here in looking at the backgrounds for Jesus coming to planet Earth. Galatians chapter 4, verse 4, and all through this, these are my own translations. In Galatians 4, 4, it says that Christ was born at the right moment in history, the fullness of time. When the fullness of time had come, God sent forth his son, born of woman, born under law, and it was at exactly the right moment in history. As God speaks through Paul here, it is the fullness of time. One of the things was that this is the era of the Roman peace. And the Romans were famous for building roads. It was easy to get the message of life around the world. Furthermore, what you had was almost everyone was conversant in either Greek or in Latin. So it tended to be easy to get the word into an understandable, in many cases it would be a second language for people, their trade language. But still, it was possible to get the message of life out simply because of the political situation, the Roman peace. There weren't wars all over the place. And with the road system, there was a much easier transportation system for being able to get the message out. And there weren't all of the difficulties of crossing international borders and so forth. Besides that, it meets the timetable in the book of Daniel. It meets all the things that the Old Testament had predicted. When Paul says it was the fullness of times, it was the perfect time for Jesus to be born. But notice, doesn't fullness of times speak of God had a plan? And as we look in the Old Testament, we're going to see that he gradually unfolded the idea of the Messiah coming forth. I haven't listed all the passages that could be listed, but I have taken some of the more strategic ones. Let's turn to Genesis chapter 3. Genesis 1 and 2 was the fall. And the fall? Creation. And chapter 3 was the fall. And so God pronounced curses upon all three that were involved in the fall. There was a curse pronounced on the serpent, one on Adam, and one on his wife. The curse that was placed on the serpent, who of course was empowered by Satan, comes in Genesis 3:15. Now I will put enmity, I will make turmoil or fighting between you, that is the serpent, and the woman, and between your seed and her seed. He shall strike your head, and you shall strike his heel. Seed of woman is going to deal a death blow because it will be a blow against the head, whereas it's only a strike against the heel that the serpent is able to execute against the seed of woman, Jesus Christ. And a strike of the heel is a logical thing to expect from a serpent. And so that's all he's capable of delivering in the final analysis.
John,
yes?
You are cursed more than all cattle. Is that...
Yeah, it's a...
Is that, I mean, the cattle are a food to eat? Or how does that work?
Well, let's look at the transition between Genesis 2 and 3. There's a play on words in Genesis 2:25 to 3:1. In 2:25, it says that they, the man and the woman, were both naked. Now that word is Ur, for naked. The man and his wife, and were not ashamed. And you remember, after they had eaten of the fruit, and by the way, we don't know that it was an apple. The Bible doesn't say what kind of fruit it was. After they ate of it, the man and the woman were hiding. And they were trying to disappear. And when they put on the coverings of fig leaves, people always picture that as fig leaf in a very strategic place. No, 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 no. They were trying to disappear.
Camouflage.
Yeah, they were trying to be just absolutely disappear.
I'll remember that from now on. Yeah.
But what happened was they heard the sound of the Lord God walking in the garden. A lot of people have thought that that says that God walks with heavy feet. No, if you look at the context, and you'll be reading this pretty quickly, what it says is that they heard him normally as he spoke to them. So he'd be calling them as he was there in the garden. They heard him as he came into the garden. Where are you? Now, God isn't trying to figure out something he doesn't know, but he was making it evident that they were hiding. But what is it that God said to them? When Adam was asked, you know, where were you? Well, I was naked. He didn't know he was naked. He didn't have any shame here as we see at this point. So God asked him, and I believe that God there is the personification of Jesus Christ. Jesus is the one that addressed them, and he said, who told you that you were naked? So notice, here in 2:25, they were both naked, the man and his wife, and were not ashamed. 3:1, now the serpent was more cunning. That's a homonym. It's also a word, Ur. And so it is a play on words with the idea of naked and cunning. He was more cunning than any beast of the field which the Lord God had made. What I see the statement there in the pronouncement, cursed above all cattle, no other beast was trying to trick man into the fall. So therefore, Satan holds as he embodied that serpent, he put it under a great curse, which animals were not under a curse. So I think that 2:25 to 3:1 is the clarification. Okay. So he's saying, none of them were under a curse, but now you are under a huge curse. So that's essentially the thrust of that.
John, I have a question.
Yes.
Okay, verse 15, you say that the seed of a woman is Jesus. So mm-hmm. What about the seed of serpent?
I have not attached that to a particular being, and that I think that it's possibly looking at unbelievers, but I'm not entirely sure what the referent is to. And that as to whether it's unbelievers or his fellow demons, I'm not exactly sure. I haven't been able to pin that down. I think the text pins down pretty clearly what he's talking about with the seed of woman. So the initial prophecy is a very broad statement. Because notice it doesn't identify what woman is going to carry this seed. And so, Chava, which is what her name is in Hebrew, Eve, as she was named in chapter 3, she thought that she was going to be the one that was going to carry seed of woman. God had not made clear in this initial prophecy that it was going to be through a lineage. So I say here that Eve surmised that she was the prophesied woman. The boy's name, that is, Cain, makes a play on the word rendered, I have acquired. Let's look at chapter 4, verse 1. I've got to make sure to put the reference earlier there in that. But as we look at 4:1, all of our English translations, I think, have a little bit of difficulty at the very end of the verse. I'll read the New King James. It says, "Now Adam knew Eve, his wife, and she conceived and bore Cain, and said, I have acquired a man from the Lord." Now you'll notice in the New King James that there's a little note next to Cain saying that literally it means to acquire. That's what his name means. And so he received this name because she had acquired something. Now, your English translations probably will say things along the line of, I have acquired a man from the Lord, or with the help of the Lord, or something along that line. And I think that all of those are misguided. There is a word et. And so you'll notice down below the verse, I have a little bit of exposition. I've given my translation. Now Adam knew Eve, his wife, and she conceived and bore Cain and said, I have acquired a man, the Lord. Now, the point where translators struggle in 4:1 is with the last three words, ish, et, and the vowels that are present with Yahweh are not the vowels that would have been originally there. Kind of a funny story. Do you know why the Jews never added the vowels for the tetragrammaton, the four letters YHWH? You know why they never did?
They never said the name, did they?
That's what people say. I'm sure that at an earlier time it was said. But they don't say it. And in fact, if you read, imagine that I have a G here, and then O and D for God. In Jewish writings, they quite often will put G underline D as a statement of don't pronounce the vowel. And so you'll see that often in Jewish writings, if it's in English instead of in Hebrew. The reason that they have refused to pronounce it is because there is a commandment that says, do not take the name of the Lord Yahweh, your God, in vain. So if you can't pronounce it because there are no vowels, there's no danger ever of doing that. Really? God seemed to say that they were in violation of that command whether they pronounced it or not, because they would invoke God, they would make vows, they would do various things, and then they wouldn't follow through on them. That's what God meant by taking the name of the Lord in vain. It's not talking about swearing in the way that we have we say swearing is taking the Lord's name in vain. Well, I wouldn't recommend doing that, but that's not what the passage was talking about. It was talking about making oaths and not following through on it. So whether or not they pronounced the name, they were still able to violate the command. But because they were saying, well, if we don't know how to say the name, then we'll never use the name in vain. That's the whole reason for them not pronouncing it. But the net effect is, we don't know exactly how the vowels were pronounced. I mean, that's been hidden from us for centuries and centuries and centuries. So it's kind of a humorous story as to why we don't have the vowels. So, Ish, Eight, and I'll just say Yahweh. You'll notice there's a hyphen between the Eight and the Yahweh, but those are two different words. Ish is the word for man or a man. It does not have the word the in front of it. And that's important. The fact that it does not have the article in front of it, the name Yahweh is always regarded as having a word the in front of it. And so our English translations will always say the Lord. Okay, so translators struggled with this little word et. I may have said eight, and that's its vocabulary form, but it's in a Macaife construction, so it's reduced down to a segal, so it's et in this passage. What translators do is they treat it as if it's another word et, and that other word et means with. And that's where they get the translation with the help of the Lord, or from the Lord, that is, from his help. But there's an absolutely huge problem with that approach. And that is that this word, if it meant with, means next to. It's that kind of a with. It's not, I wrote this paper with a pen. That is the idea of by means of. But it is instead saying, I am sitting here with a lamp. There's a lamp right here, and there's even Santa Claus next to me. And so that's the kind of with, next to. Now, would it make sense in this passage to say, I have acquired a man next to the Lord?
No.
That doesn't make any sense at all. So what translators have done is they have neglected the range of meaning. And in fact, the main lexicon says this is an exceptional usage. In other words, they're saying, we can't find any places where this word means with the help of. And yet that's the way that they wanted to render it. I think it's a different word, et. And that word is used when there are two things that happen. There is another word, et. It says that the word that follows is definite. It means that whether or not it has the word the attached to it, that it is understood as having the word the attached to it. And the second thing is it has to be an object of a verb or be in apposition to that. Notice my translation. I've acquired a man, comma, the Lord. What man is she saying that she has acquired? The Lord. That's what it means by an apposition. I've acquired a man, Cain, this little baby. She had wonderful expectations of her firstborn. Every mother does. Cain did not live up to her expectations. But what is significant about it is, why would she make this statement when her son is born? She's saying, our deliverer, the one who is going to crush the serpent's head, is seed of woman. I'm the only woman in the world. This is my seed. Whoa! Here is our deliverer. Now, she didn't have the right reference. Cain is not the Messiah. Sorry to disappoint Eve, but no, Cain was not the Messiah. He showed brotherly love in chapter 4, the first murder in the Bible. But what has she said? She has indicated that she has believed what God told the serpent. She is telling us about her faith. And I find that very significant. God made a promise, and he said that the deliverer who would crush the serpent's head would be seed of woman. She understands he's going to be born of woman. She says, I'm woman. This is seed of woman. Here's the deliverer. But she is giving very clear testimony to the fact that she has believed God's promise that he made in the form of a curse upon Satan. Now, I don't have it here in the notes, but do you have any idea where you would go to find out anything about Adam's faith? People sometimes do talk about, we have evidence of what the woman believed, but do we have evidence of what he believed? Yes, Diane.
Eve.
Ah, yes, very good. She was named by Adam. And I'd like for you to look at that passage. It's in Genesis 3, and this is after the fall, but look at 3:20. And Adam, and by the way, Adam just means man, it's all means, he called his wife's name Hava, Eve, because she was the mother of all living. How many children had she had at this point? Zero. Is he not giving indication that he understands the promise that was made? Look at how, first of all, seed of woman was going to be the one that was going to crush the serpent's head. But secondly, look at 3:16. To the woman he said, I will greatly multiply your sorrow and your conception. In pain you shall bring forth children. What has happened here is he is giving indication of believing the things that God has pronounced here. And I would say there was obviously more that was said, but both of them have given indication of believing what God has said that is pertinent to how the deliverer would come. We can't get as precise as we might like to get, but this does give a clear indication that they understood some important things. Let's skip a long way down in history to Genesis 22, verse 18, and 21:12. These two verses clarify that there's going to be a lineage. It's not just seed of woman, but there's going to be a lineage, and that lineage would be through Abraham. More specifically, the lineage would come through Isaac, a son of Abraham. And remember, Abraham had two important sons, Ishmael and Isaac. He had other sons by another wife after Sarah died. And her name was Keturah, and she had a number of children. Does not Genesis 22:18 look a lot like Genesis 12:3? Mm-hmm. In your seed, all nations of the earth shall be blessed because you have obeyed my voice. In Isaac, your seed shall be called. So we have two key passages. What does Genesis 12:3 say, which I didn't record here?
I will make you a great nation. I will bless you. I will make your name great. Be a blessing. I will curse those who curse you, and I will say, I will bless, curse, curse. I will
bless
those who bless you, and I will curse him who curses you, and in you all the families of the earth shall be blessed.
Very good.
Thanks, Lord.
And so the lineage is going to be in Abraham, but more specifically, is going to be through Isaac. And so Genesis 12:3 doesn't expand on his statement when he says, in you. But it's in you, that is, in your lineage, is going to be the one who is going to be a blessing to all the families of the earth, or as it's stated here, all the nations of the earth. Now you may well remember that I've said that the Abrahamic covenant that God made with Abraham starting in Genesis 12 is unconditional. It didn't matter whether Abraham obeyed or not. God had made promises. He was going to keep those promises. Whether or not Abraham obeyed, whether or not Israel obeyed. But I will tell you, God determines the timing of when he brings it to fruition. And the time when the second advent happens is going to be his second coming, when he establishes the kingdom, is going to be at a point when all of Israel looks and lives. Every Jewish person on planet Earth, according to Romans chapter 11, at the time that he splits the sky and is ready to come down, every Jewish person alive is going to believe. There's going to be universal belief among Israelites. And besides that, they will all repent. So God said, I'm going to do this. But he didn't say when he was going to do it. And the when is determined by obedience. But it's not in question whether or not he will do it. Now, as you look at Genesis 22:18, there's reason to question what I just said. This is right after Genesis chapter 22. In Genesis 16, Ishmael was born. Genesis 17, God clarifies the Abrahamic covenant. And then God comes and meets with Abraham in chapter 18, chapter 19, we have the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah. And then in chapter 20, Abraham goes off to Egypt. 21, Isaac is born. 22, Abraham offers Isaac. And so he says, in your seed, that was specifically Isaac, in Isaac your seed shall be called, all nations of the earth shall be blessed because you have obeyed my voice. Now when we see that word because, it looks like it creates a problem. Because I've said the Abrahamic covenant was unconditional. And people have looked at this and said, I'm going to do this because you obeyed. Doesn't that sound like there's a condition attached? Yes, it does. I've got a footnote here. Some claim that Genesis 22:18b treats the Abrahamic covenant as conditional. Not so. What happens here is God promises to do even more than what he had promised in 12:3. Because Abraham was willing to sacrifice Isaac. By analogy, a father promised his son, next week I will give you $20 as a gift. You don't have to earn it. I'm giving you $20. But a week later he says, because you especially pleased me yesterday, here is $50, not $20. The $20 was unconditional. The $30 bonus was for obedience. Genesis 22:18 does not convert the Abrahamic covenant into a conditional covenant. What happens is God offers incentive clauses. And the incentive clauses can have conditionality attached to them, but it does not change the nature of the covenant as a whole. So Genesis 22:18 does not make the Abrahamic covenant conditional. Now it's pretty easy with Abraham. Abraham hasn't had any children that God would regard as heirs of the covenant until Isaac came along. Ishmael didn't count in that sense. Not saying that Ishmael was not a believer. I am certain that he was. But he was not the one through whom the messianic line would come. The passages here are not talking about whether people are believers or unbelievers, whether their destiny is with God or apart from God. That's not what's being spoken of. What is being spoken of is through whom does the messianic line come. Now at this point, I'm making assertions. Pretty soon I'm going to be demonstrating assertions. So if I don't do that in the near future, you have every right to say, John, you haven't proven the assertion you said you were going to prove. So right now I'm making it as an assertion that the issue here is the messianic line, not individual salvation. But it's pretty easy. God says to Abraham, the only one that's going to count is Isaac. So no matter how many kids he has, that's the one through whom Abraham's seed are called. But now all of a sudden, we have two sons of Isaac, Jacob and Esau. And there the question becomes, who is going to carry the messianic line? Is it going to be Jacob? Is it going to be Esau? Or are they going to have to do like they do at the start of the Broncos game and flip a coin? Okay. Let's look here at when God is making promises before the children are born. So we have a little bit of an insight into Rebekah's pregnancy with these twins. Rebekah is the wife of Isaac. Here in the passage it says, then the children struggled together within her. And she said, if this is so, why am I this way? So she went to seek the Lord. She prayed. Then the Lord said to her, two nations are in your womb. Two people shall be separated from your body. One people shall be stronger than the other. That is the other people. The people of the older, and notice I put a few of these in brackets, shall serve the people of the younger. The emphasis is not on Jacob and Esau as individuals. The emphasis is on the nations that would come from them. Let's go back to Genesis chapter 17. As God sets forth the Abrahamic covenant with Abraham, he renamed him. Remember, his name was Abram. And what God tells him in verse 5, no longer shall your name be called Abram, Abram, but your name shall be Abraham, for I have made you a father of a multitude of nations. Often people look in the New Testament and they say that Paul speaks about when people believe in Jesus Christ, they become Abraham's children. Well, let me ask a logic question. Does that make all people who believe in Jesus Christ Jewish? No, because Abraham would be the father of many nations, and most of those nations, all except Israel, are Gentile nations. So it's a leap of logic for people to say someone believes in Jesus Christ and God regards them as Jewish because Abraham is the father of Jews, so therefore all children of Abraham must be Jews. Very bad logic. Abraham is going to be the father of many nations. Interestingly enough, the passage here in Genesis 17, bad translation when it says, I will make you. Because concept is, I have made you a father of many nations. God already regarded it as true. Now, I say that an important issue is often overlooked in these verses, which appears here in bold print. God's words to Rebekah focused not on the two boys, but on the nations they would father. And I would say this is not unexpected, because God had said to Abram, you are the father of many nations. Abraham's status as the father of a multitude of nations, each headed by a king, would be true not only through the lineages of Ishmael, and his lineage is given in one of those genealogies, Genesis 25. By the way, genealogies, people tend to get to them in the Bible and they want to say, what's this here for? You'll be able to ask me about those. Every genealogy in the Bible has a purpose. And a lot of the genealogies are tracing the messianic line and ultimately showing that Jesus Christ legitimately lays claim to the title of Messiah. Genealogies have a great deal of importance. So he has lineage through Ishmael, traced in Genesis 25, and the sons of Keturah. That was the woman that he married after Sarah died, and he fathered children through her. So there were a multitude of nations that came directly from Abram. But then Esau, that is one of the two sons of Isaac, also has a lineage with nations and kings traced in Genesis 36. So therefore, Israel is not the only nation that comes from Abraham. Now, within the context of Genesis, as well as the context of Romans 9, what is the focus of God choosing Jacob, not Esau? You know, what's the emphasis? Is he talking about one's going to go to heaven and the other one's going to go to hell? I say absolutely not. That is not the picture at all. The answer to that question appears earlier in Genesis. God had only promised one seed of woman in Genesis 3:15. He had only promised one lineage through Abraham, which is the line of Isaac, through which all nations of the earth would be blessed. So with the birth of Isaac's twins, only one nation would be chosen to carry the messianic line, and that's Israel, not Edom. So we're going to take two excursies, where we're going to take a footnote, we're going to kind of go on a rabbit trail for a little bit. So excursus says time out from the main session, we're going into another issue. Excursus number one. Many imagine that passages speaking of God choosing Jacob, not Esau, refer to the eternal destinies of two men, whether heaven or hell. But that is not the point at all. No Old Testament passage, correctly understood, portrays Esau as an unbeliever. Furthermore, Hebrews 12:15 and following warns believers against throwing away their reward as Esau threw away his reward. Let's look at Hebrews chapter 12. This is in the fifth warning of the book of Hebrews. We looked at the warning passages in Hebrews, the consequence passages in Hebrews a while back. The book of Hebrews is written to believers. Look at chapter 13, verse 22. And I appeal to you, brethren, bear with the word of exhortation. And the author of Hebrews has defined who the brethren are in chapter 2, verse 11. Let's go back to Hebrews 2, 11. For both he who sanctifies, that's Jesus Christ, and those who are sanctified, if your translation says being, you have my permission to scratch it out. For both he who sanctifies, Jesus Christ, and those who are sanctified, believers, are all of one. All of one Father is the idea. How do we know that? Look at where he goes in the next part of the verse. For which reason he is not ashamed to call them brethren, saying, I will declare your name to my brethren. In the midst of the assembly I will sing praise to you. 13b, and again, here am I and the children whom God has given me. And look at 3:1. Therefore, holy brethren, and the word holy is from the same root as sanctified from verse 11 of chapter 2. In this book, when he talks about brethren, he's talking about people who have believed and therefore have been sanctified. The author of Hebrews, who is not Paul, uses sanctify in the way that Paul normally uses the word justify. He's talking about believers. So, Hebrews is addressing brethren. He's not addressing unbelievers. And what does he say in 12:15 and following? We'll start at 14. Pursue peace with all people and holiness, without which no one will see the Lord. Looking carefully, lest anyone fall short of the grace of God. Lest any root of bitterness springing up cause trouble, and by this many become defiled. Lest there be any fornicator or profane person like Esau, who for one morsel of food sold his birthright. He's saying, believers, don't do what Esau did. Esau threw away his reward. It's an exhortation to believers not to be like Esau. Not an exhortation to unbelievers. Don't be like Esau the unbeliever. It's believers, don't do what Esau the believer did. There is no Old Testament passage that makes the assertion that Esau was an unbeliever. There is no New Testament passage that does so, and I would argue that Hebrews 12 regards Esau as a believer. So, that's going to have ramifications in Romans 9. So, looking back at excursus number 1, I do not see this as talking about a choice for heaven or hell. This is talking about a choice of who is going to carry the messianic line. How many messianic lines can there be? One. Because there's only how many messiahs? One. So there's only one messianic line. God didn't say in the garden, seed of women, or seeds of woman. It's one seed. Excursus 2. This is a passage that is often used. Malachi chapter 1, verses 1 through 5. Malachi is the last book of the Old Testament, so right before Matthew. In Malachi 1, 1 through 5. So it's the very start of the book. I mean, the opening section of the book. The burden of the word of the Lord to Israel. By the hand of Malachi. I have loved you, says the Lord, and yet you will say, in what way have you loved us? Was not Esau Jacob's brother, says the Lord? Yet, Jacob I have loved, but Esau I have hated. And people look at this and they say, that man, Jacob, God loved, and that man, Esau, God hated. So God sent Jacob to heaven, and he sent Esau to hell. But let's look at where Malachi goes, and let me remind you, Malachi was written 900 years after Genesis was written. This is a long, long, long time later. It's one of the last books of the Old Testament. Malachi 1 verse 2 said that Jacob I have loved, but Esau I have hated, and laid waste his mountains and his inheritance for the jackals of the wilderness. Even though Edom, why is he talking about Edom? Well, if we were to look back at Genesis 36, which traces the genealogy of Esau, he was the father of the nation of Edom. Edom is southeast of Israel, one of its neighbors, part of Jordan, modern-day Jordan. So even though Edom, that is, when he talks about Esau, he's talking about Esau's nation, the nation of Edom. Even though Edom has said, we have been impoverished, but we will return and build the ruins. Thus says the Lord of armies. They may build, but I will throw down. They shall be called the territory of wickedness, and people against whom the Lord will have indignation forever. Your eyes shall say, and you shall say, the Lord is magnified beyond the territory of Israel. When he says, Jacob I have loved, he means Israel I have loved. I chose Israel. Israel is the lineage through whom the Messiah comes. Not through Esau. Not through Edom. And when you look at Romans chapter 9, Romans chapter 9 is focused on God made promises to Israel. Does that mean that every Israelite, that every descendant of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob gets eternal life? No. What is traced in Romans chapter 9 is that not all of Israel would respond to God's promises. And God was not saying that there would be universality, and that just because someone can trace their lineage back through Abraham, that they were part of God's plan and they were going to have participation and blessing in the millennium. He says, after all, you have Jacob and Esau, and one of them was chosen to be the lineage for the Messiah, the other one wasn't. And what also happens in Romans chapter 9, it says that Pharaoh stood up. Why was Israel afraid of Pharaoh? Because he had an army. Pharaoh represents Egypt. So the question is going to be, can Edom stand in God's way for God accomplishing what he promised Israel? No. Can Egypt stand in the way? No. Can North Korea stand in the way? No. Can the United States stand in the way? No. No matter who arrays themselves against God's plan, God said the line of blessing was going to be through Israel. Israel is going to be where the seat of world government is going to be during the millennial kingdom. God fulfills all of his plans. He chose Israel for the lineage and for the location. And nobody interferes with his plan. And the passages are not talking about getting eternal life. The passages are talking about God going to keep the promises that he made to the nation.
So basically he's saying, I chose Israel, the seed to come through, and I didn't choose Edom.
That's right.
It has nothing to do with the two persons.
That's right. Is look at what he said to Rebecca. Two nations are in your womb. Is the focus, I mean, right from the beginning, before they're born, God's looking at nations, not individuals. And people tend to overlook that. The focus is on nations. Because the promise had been made to Abraham, you are the father of many nations. But there was only going to be one messianic line.
Joe?
Yes.
Is the hate part of that? Is that exaggeration? Because it seems contrary to God's nature.
Okay. I'm glad you asked that. When one traces the blessings given to Esau and to his lineage, they were considerable. Even the blessings that Isaac pronounced on his sons, there was quite a bit of blessing extended to Esau. And the Bible does spend a fair amount of time talking about the blessings that God is giving to the nation of Edom. But by contrast, it looks like hate in comparison with how God had showered blessing upon Israel for all of human history extending into the millennium. And in this particular passage, Edom has attacked the nation of Judah when Judah was already down because of the Babylonians. In other words, the Babylonians had decimated Judah, and Edom decided to go in and attack and take spoils. And so this passage is being particularly written against them, saying, you should never have done that. They were down and out, and then you attack them. And so Edom has culpability for the actions that they took that are described in 2 Kings.
So it's really kind of a bit of hyperbole or whatever.
Yes. Yeah.
Overstatement, kind of.
I saw another hand. Dang.
Do you remember when Jacob was afraid, you know, he was bringing all his family.
And he sent everyone ahead.
And he was, and finally he got to, was it Esau or
yep.
his brother? And he kept sending all of his goods, you know, his animals, wealth. And he says, why are you doing that? I have so much in my home.
Right, absolutely.
Remember that?
Yeah, when I've... After Jacob and Rebekah tricked Isaac, and as a result, Esau ended up with the short end of the stick, Esau said, I'm going to kill him. he was ready to do in Jacob. And so Rebekah suggested that Jacob take off for a little while until Esau cooled off. Interestingly enough, Rebecca and Jacob never saw each other. Rebecca died before Jacob came back into the land. But then, as he was there dealing with his relative Laban, he had to work for 7 years for one wife and got tricked while he was drunk. And that, so there, all of a sudden, he finds himself married to the other sister. He ends up putting in 14 years, everything keeps getting rearranged and all of that. He ran into a shrewd camel trader that was even shrewder than he was. Well, then ultimately he wanted to come back to the land of Israel, and he did so, but he thought, uh-oh, Esau's going to want to kill me. So good old courageous Jacob goes up and meets directly with Esau. No way. He sent his least favorite children and servants and the handmaids through whom he had had those children. They go first and they say, "We've got gifts to give you, Esau." And then there's another wave and another wave and another wave. And there's Jacob at the very end. And Esau's saying, "What's all this about?" Basically, Jacob figured that he needed to bribe Esau so that Esau would say, "Oh, wow, I can share in some of your blessing. Okay, I won't kill you." Esau, I think I would probably have liked Esau better than Jacob, but God chose Jacob, so Jacob's the hero of the story. Not because Jacob's so great, but because the Lord was able to work through the circumstances. I find it very interesting how God did work, so that by the end of Jacob's life, he was a lot different than he was at earlier stages in his life. I think you're going to have fun reading in Genesis.
Isn't Jacob deception? Doesn't it mean deception?
Supplanter, heel grabber, and yeah. So let's go to Genesis 28:4. In this passage, what we have is not only is the line going through Isaac as we knew that it would, but Jacob is going to have 12 sons and Dinah, who's in the kitchen with Dinah. But instead of Jacob producing 13 nations, what he produces is 12 tribes for one nation. And so no longer would it be separated into separate national entities, but it would be separate tribal entities. So with the choice of Jacob's line as the messianic one, Israel became the national entity through which the Messiah would be born. In that regard, Isaac pronounces Jacob and his seed, not Esau, as heirs to the Abrahamic covenant in Genesis 28:4. And I borrowed a few words from the preceding verse. "And may El Shaddai give you," and the SG stand for a singular. This is, "May he give you, Jacob, the blessing of Abraham, to you, Jacob, and to your seed with you, that you may inherit the land of your sojournings, which God gave to Abraham." What's being said here is you and your seed are going to be the inheritors of the promises that God made to Abraham. So no longer was the promise deliver just seed of woman, nor just Abraham's seed called through Isaac. Now he was to be Abraham's seed called through both Isaac and Jacob. But we have a very, very interesting passage near the end of Genesis. As you remember, there were two sons that Jacob had that were born through Rachel. One was Joseph and one was Benjamin. That was the favored wife and they were the favored children. God ended up giving Joseph a double portion. And it happened in a very interesting way that's described in Genesis 48. What happened was Jacob adopted his two grandsons born through Joseph as his own children. And he gave them each a portion. And in giving each of them a portion, it ends up being a double portion to Joseph. So chapter 48 describes that, the adoption and the passing on a blessing. A very, very interesting passage. But then in Genesis 49, Jacob goes through and pronounces blessings on the rest of the children. And the first three children born, Reuben, Levi, and Simeon, all were disqualified from an inheritance. They received inheritance, but none of them could receive rulership. They couldn't receive the prize. So the fourth one born became the firstborn. So, Genesis 49:10, this is the pronouncement made upon Judah, the fourth son of Jacob. All of the sons together constituted one nation, Israel. This contrasts with the offspring of Abraham and Isaac, whose children represented various nations. This did not mean that each of the 12 sons would have his own messianic line. There's only one messianic line. In Genesis 48 through 49, Jacob blessed each of the tribes. 48, it was blessing the two grandsons. 49 is blessing all the sons. His three eldest sons, Reuben, Simeon, and Levi, had each forfeited firstborn rights, and the particulars are discussed at the beginning of Genesis 49. So Judah, the fourth one born, receives it. And his blessing is 49:8 through 12. Verse 10 is strategic because it narrows the promised lineage, the promised messianic lineage, to one tribe, Judah. It says the scepter, which is a symbol of rulership, a symbol of being a king. The scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor one who decrees, makes decrees as a king, makes decrees over a nation, until Shiloh comes. And he will have the obedience of the peoples, plural. Not just the nation Israel, but the world. This is looking to Messiah ruling over the world in the millennial kingdom. Now, question arises over the name Shiloh, but we'll get to that. The oracle promises a ruling dynasty, culminating in one who can be described by the term Shiloh. How does this verse speak of a dynastic lineage? The second stanza describes procreative activity in polite terms when he says that one who decrees shall not depart from between his feet. Talking about that there would be a lineage through procreation of ones able to make decrees, that is, as kings. So generation after generation of those who issue decrees, that is, kings, will hold the ruling scepter until Shiloh comes. So who is Shiloh? Shiloh is a compounded term. The first part, Sheh, derives from a shortened form of the relative pronoun asher. And asher means who, which, whose, etc. So sheh means whose or whom or who. That's the idea. And lo is compounded form that means to him. Now a Hebrew, as I point out in the note, does not have a verb to have. And that was one of our problems in making a translation of the living water for Arabic. Semitic languages don't have a verb to have. So if you want to say, I have a wife, they can't say it. And the circumlocution that is used is, a wife is to me. Because they simply do, Semitic languages do not have a verb to have. That creates a big problem in how do you communicate a passage like John 5:24. Truly, truly, I say to you, he who hears my word and believes in the one who sent me has everlasting life. For Arabic or Hebrew, we can say everlasting life is to him. How many people do you think will catch the point out of that? It's not particularly clear. Furthermore, there is no such thing as a present tense in Semitic languages. So a person could interpret it as, it will be to him. It's really hard to bring across the idea. It's something you have right now. So what did we say in rendering it? We said that the one who believes in the one who sent Christ lives forever. It's really hard to get around the lack of a verb to have. And Hebrew tends to like to omit verbs in a lot of statements because they say the verb is self-evident. So when it says, whose to him, Shiloh, what it means is, to whom it belongs. The scepter shall not depart until the one to whom it belongs comes. Every king of Judah, starting with David, was a caretaker who tended the scepter. But Shiloh, Jesus Christ, is the one to whom the scepter belongs. It's his by right. Others were allowed to have the position of king, but they were not the ones to whom it belonged. Jesus will be the one to whom it belongs. So then another passage that we memorized part of, 2 Samuel 7, verses 12 through 16. It amplifies Genesis 49:10. Specifically, God promises David, a descendant of Judah, one of those persons who issued decrees, that he would establish forever a royal Davidic royal dynasty and would establish the throne forever. Indeed, David's successors to the throne were all from his lineage. When you look at every king of the nation of Judah, the southern kingdom, after the kingdom split, every single one was a descendant of David. When you look at the northern kingdom, there were a couple of times that the line was killed off, and it was separate dynasties. But God promised to David that there would always be someone out of his lineage that would always be qualified to issue decrees. Clear until the one to whom that right belongs. And when we look at Christmas, that unbroken lineage is something that God fulfilled in Jesus Christ. The Old Testament, those historical books that I have set out for the reading, there are a lot of places where they have genealogies, and they are tracing this lineage. They didn't always know where it was pointing, but they carefully traced it. So now, final page of the notes. We think about it, how long has it been since there's been a king on the throne of Israel? Been a long time. 583 BC is the last time that Judah had a king sitting on the throne. But up until the time of Christ, there always was someone qualified to sit on the throne if God would have allowed it. But God did not promise that there would always be someone ruling. What he promised was there would always be someone qualified. There's a difference. Consider Jeremiah 22:30's famous curse, and you'll be hearing about this, I'm sure, when you are at Christmas services this year. Jeremiah 22:30's famous curse on Jehoiakim. He went by several nicknames. The last Davidic king of Judah. Thus says the Lord, write this man childless. A man who shall not prosper in his days, for none of his seed shall prosper, sitting on the throne of David and ruling any more in Judah. When it says, write this man childless, it does not mean he didn't have children. He already had children by this point, and in my footnotes I list passages that list children of his. But notice how it says, none of his seed, his offspring, shall prosper. Well, what kind of prosperity is he speaking about? Prospering by sitting on the throne of David. He said, not a single one of his physical descendants will ever sit on David's throne. Not one, ever. That creates an interesting problem, doesn't it? Because there's always going to be someone qualified to sit on the throne, but God says, not one of this man, through whom the lineage ought to go, will ever sit on the throne. And this is where the virgin birth becomes very strategic. In Matthew, Matthew describes Joseph's genealogy. Take a look at Matthew chapter 1. Matthew chapter 1 is talking about Joseph's genealogy. The book of the genealogy of Jesus Christ, the son of David, the son of Abraham. Abraham begot Isaac. Isaac begot Jacob. Jacob begot Judah and his brothers. Judah begot Perez and Zerah by Tamar. Perez begot Hezron, and Hezron begot Ram. Ram begot Amminadab, Amminadab begot Nahshon, Nahshon begot Salmon, Salmon begot Boaz by Rahab, Boaz begot Obed by Ruth, Obed begot Jesse, and Jesse begot David the king. David the king begot Solomon by her who had been the wife of Uriah. So this is going through Bathsheba. For the lineage of David, it's a lineage being traced through Bathsheba. Luke traces a different genealogy through a different son of David. Luke traces the genealogy of Mary. So let's look at this. Verse 7 again. Solomon begot Rehoboam, Rehoboam begot Abijah, Abijah begot Asa, Asa begot Jehoshaphat, Jehoshaphat begot Joram, Joram begot Uzziah, Uzziah begot Jotham, Jotham begot Ahaz, Ahaz begot Hezekiah, Hezekiah begot Manasseh, Manasseh begot Ammon, Ammon begot Josiah, Josiah begot Jeconiah. Another name for him is Jehoiakim. This is the one that got cursed, that none of his descendants would ever sit on the throne of David. And Jesus is going to be claimant to the throne of David. So it says, Josiah begot Jeconiah and his brothers about the time they were carried away to Babylon. And after they were brought to Babylon, Jeconiah begot Shealtiel, and so on and so on. And finally, if you look at verse 16, Jacob begot Joseph, the husband of Mary, through whom was born Jesus, who is called Christ. This is the genealogy of Joseph. It is not the genealogy of Mary. Now let's turn to Luke 3. Luke goes in the opposite direction for his genealogy. instead of starting early, he starts late and traces it in the opposite direction. So starting at verse 23. Now Jesus himself began his ministry at about 30 years of age, being, as was supposed, the son of Joseph, the son of Heli, son of Matthat, and so on and so forth. And when you get down to David, here in the listing, verse 31, the son of Nathan, the son of David. We won't go through all the technical reasons, but this is the genealogy of Mary, and her lineage comes through a different son of David. The virgin birth plays a prominent role here, because he has to be able to have legal claim through the Davidic line that went through Jeconiah, the last member of the Davidic dynasty to sit on the throne of Judah. But he cannot be a physical descendant of Jeconiah and still be qualified to sit on the throne. So when we look at how Galatians 4 says, in the fullness of times, God sent forth his son, born of a woman, born under the law. God had a plan, and he gradually unfolded it and kept revealing more and more and more about it. I'd like for us to look, in closing, at one passage that tends to cause people some consternation in the book of Matthew. Look at Matthew chapter 2. We'll start at verse 13. Now when they had departed, that is the wise men, behold, an angel of the Lord appeared to Joseph in a dream, saying, arise, take the young child and his mother, flee to Egypt, and stay there until I bring you word, for Herod will seek the young child to destroy him. When he arose, he took the young child and his mother by night and departed for Egypt, and was there until the death of Herod, that it might be fulfilled which was spoken by the Lord through the prophet, saying, out of Egypt I have called my son. Now when it says that it would be fulfilled, are we expecting there to be an Old Testament prophecy saying that God would call the Messiah out of Egypt? That's how people tend to read this. But this passage, Hosea chapter 11, 1, is not a prophecy. And it might be surprising who is regarded as Israel's son. Take a look at Hosea 11, 1. It's near the beginning of the minor prophets. So if you get to Daniel, you know, in California, there's a city of San Jose. Well, in the Bible, it goes Dan Jose. Daniel Hosea. So Daniel's a relatively long book, so Dan Jose.
I won't forget that. Mine was like, every day have coffee or something, or Java.
Look at Hosea 11:1. When Israel was a child, I loved him. And out of Egypt I called my son. As they called them, so they went out from them. They sacrificed to the Baals and burned incense to carved images. He's looking at the Exodus. This is not a prophecy. But who is the son? Israel. Now, does that seem like a problem? Here Matthew says, this fulfills what was spoken by the prophet, saying, out of Egypt I called my son. Well, let's ask a question. Was not the messianic line contained within Israel? And didn't God know that that messianic line was going to be in Israel? Seed of woman. And he told Abraham, in you all families of the earth shall be blessed. Then he told Abraham, in Isaac your seed shall be called. And in your seed all nations of the earth shall be blessed. And in Genesis 49, 400 years before the Exodus, 400 plus years, Jacob pronounced upon Judah, his fourth son, that the scepter would never depart from Judah, nor a lawgiver, a one who makes decrees, from between his feet, until the one to whom it belongs comes. God was willing to protect the whole nation of Israel in order to safeguard his messianic son, Jesus Christ. So what is being said by Matthew is, of course God protected Messiah and was willing to send him temporarily as a young child to Egypt to protect him from Herod. Because it's always been God's policy to protect the messianic line, even if it required protecting the whole nation to do that. So when it says, out of Egypt I called my son, I think that there are two sons there. There's a messianic son who is contained within the nation. And so when we look at Christmas, and when we look at the birth of Jesus Christ, we are looking at God has taken extraordinary measures to make sure that his promises happen exactly the way that he promised them. So I think this is a little different slant than you normally hear for Christmas messages. But I think it's just, it tremendously enriches looking at the events during the life of Joseph and Mary to understand that there is a big tapestry that God has rearranged history in order that he can keep his promises. So I gave you fairly extensive notes, and this will be appearing in our newsletter in a slightly edited form. So it'll be possible to look over it, since we won't be reviewing next week.
So this last part, John, Matthew's saying God used Egypt to protect his nation, which would come the seed, and to protect the seed.
That's right.
So his promise would be good.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just helping us to understand he will go to any length to
That's
protect
right.
his promise.
Yeah, when you look at the passage there in Matthew 2, it's not saying this is a prophecy. It's saying this is God's policy. So it's lots of people have struggled with this passage and said, Matthew's treating it like a prophecy and it's no prophecy. And people say there are all kinds of problems in the Bible. And I say, it's because we don't understand the Bible well enough that we think there are problems. There are things that I don't understand that look like problems to me. But what does that tell me? It tells me more about myself than about God. It tells me that there are things that I lack. If we understand what God is saying in His Word, the problems end up disappearing. It's when we don't understand, it looks like there are insurmountable problems. Our tendency is to try to use theology to rescue God from His problems. What we need instead is we need to come to understand His Word well. The better we understand His Word, that's where the problems are resolved. And so I think a chronological read through the Old Testament is a good way for us to start in 2014.